Translation. Saintly persons may freely associate with those who are poverty-stricken, but not those who are rich. A poverty-stricken man, by association with saintly persons, very soon becomes uninterested in material desires, and the dirty things within the core of the heart are cleansed away. Prabhupada's purport. It is said, Mahavichalanam Ninam Grinam Dina Chetasam, from the Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 8-4. So that's just a few chapters ago. The only business of a saintly person or sannyasi, a person in the renounced order, is to preach Krishna consciousness. Sadhus, saintly persons, want to preach to both the rich and the poor, but the poor take more advantage of the sadhus' preaching than the rich do. A poor man receives sadhus very quickly, offering them obeisances, and tries to take advantage of their presence, whereas a rich man keeps a big greyhound dog at his door, so that no one can enter his house. He posts a sign saying, "Beware of the dog," and avoids the association of saintly persons, whereas a poor man keeps his door open for them, and thus benefits by their association more than a rich man. Because Narad Muni, in his previous life, was the poverty-stricken son of a maidservant, he got the association of saintly persons, and later became the exalted Narad Muni. This was his actual experience. Therefore, he is now comparing the position of a poor man with that of a rich man. Satam Pashangam Mama Vidya Samvido Bhavanti Hit Karna Rasayana Kata Taj Joshanat Dasivatpa Bhagad Matmani Shradavati Bhakti Anukram Misyati Bhavatam 3:25-25. If one gets the advantage of association with saintly persons, by their instructions one becomes more and more purified of material desires. Krishna bahi mukha haya boga panchakare nikatasta mayatare japatiyadare. Material life means that one forgets Krishna and one increases in one's desires for sense gratification. But if one receives the advantage of instructions from saintly persons and forgets the importance of material desires, one is automatically purified. Cheto dapana majanam bhava maha dvabhagni nivarpanam. That's the, of course, from the Shishastika. Unless the core of a materialistic person's heart is purified, he cannot get rid of the pangs of bhava maha dvabhagni, the blazing fire of material existence. The verse again. Saintly persons may freely associate with those who are poverty-stricken, but not those who are rich. A poverty-stricken man, by association with saintly persons, very soon becomes uninterested in material desires, and the dirty things within the core of his heart are cleansed away. Om Agyanam Tridam Dasha Janangala Shalakaya Taksu Om Nisham Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Titanya Manobistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Garam Maya Dadati Svapadantikam He Krishna Kuruna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagapate Gopisha Gopi Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vasaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gurvani Chaune Nivasesha Shunyavadi Prashachade Satarine Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siyadvaita Gadadha Sivasadi Gurva Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. I like the fact that Prabhupada in his purport here specifically says rich people keep dogs at their door with a sign saying beware of the dog. Obviously he's generalizing there, but it gives you a general idea of perhaps the mentality of many wealthy people. The more wealth you have, the more you have to protect it. You've got to defend it. You know, you have a wonderful big house and then you've got to think, okay, now I need walls to protect that house. I've got to defend it now from burglars, and so one has to have a dog in this case. But of course, generally, material opulence, if one is born into material opulence, or if one acquires material opulence and riches, that's not a bad thing in itself. Nevertheless, it can potentially be a huge distraction. For example, how many people here can honestly say, honestly really say that if they won £500 million in the lottery, they would be sitting here this morning. If you won that amount, yeah, you sure? Would you donate it all to the temple? Yeah. Yeah. There's so many cases of people who've actually said, if I become rich, they'll give to the temple. When it comes down to it, it's a bit harder than they actually expect. Because that is the nature of the material energy. The more material opulence we have, the more we have to protect, and the more we associate with temporal things. Because at the end of the day, you're born into this world with nothing, and you die with nothing, from the womb to the burning ghat or the coffin or whatever. One cannot take your big house, your big car, your Mercedes, Benz, your BMW, your bank account with you. So I think that's very important. In other words, one of the purposes here is that it's saying that the best remedy for wealthy people ultimately is association of saintly persons and sadhus. And Prabhupada is a good example of that, in fact. Because sadhus, of course, are less attached and are able to bestow their mercy ultimately, if they're the pure devotees, to anyone, whether they're rich or poor. But as the purport suggests here, if someone's poor, they've got less attachments because, frankly, they've got no choice. And therefore, perhaps death is not so far away, particularly in certain countries around the world where perhaps the mortality rate is a lot higher. Death is not an abstract concept, or it's not tucked away in the corner somewhere, or it's actually an everyday reality for them. And thus, you'll find there's no atheists in the foxhole, so to speak. In other words, the Western countries tend to be more atheistic in general, and there tends to be a greater denial of the fact that we're all going to die, essentially. Whereas in cultures and societies and countries where perhaps death is an everyday reality, there is less attachment, because that perhaps they are able to put things into a greater context. Being situated in the mode of goodness often can put one in a very comfortable position. If one is in the mode of goodness, one is good at health, is not short of money, nice leafy suburb, children are nice, they're all going to university and so on. And so you've got a nice comfortable situation due to one's actions in one's life, hard work and endeavour, due to perhaps influence of the mode of goodness. Okay, fair enough. And that person may even be philanthropic, may give to local hospitals and so forth. And of course, that's fine. However, is it enough? And the idea is that the mode of goodness alone, without transcendence and without the association of sadhus, is just another mode of nature where one is still not completely free from the pangs of material existence, because one can give to material things. One can look after the health or the material or the physical world around them. However, one thing it all has in common, hospital or no hospital, none of it is permanent. So those who actually give their time and energy, donating, for example, to the sadhus and to the Krishna conscious movement, for example, and movements like it, are actually being truly philanthropic in the true sense, because they have the true interests of people's hearts. So the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is not necessarily to be a society of beggars, at least not outside of, in terms of congregation support, but rather to engage whatever wealth one has, whether it's a penny or £1 million, engage that in Krishna's service. That is Krishna consciousness. Jesus Christ himself actually said that he made a very strong comment. He said that the chances of a rich person getting to heaven is about the same as a camel getting through the eye of a needle, or an elephant, or depending on where you come from. So a similar analogy. So trying to get a large animal for the eye of a needle, pretty hard. So it takes a miracle to actually widen that needle or to shrink the camel. But it's possible. It's possible by the association of pure devotees. Study the Bhagavatam, and that person, that wealthy person, is able to thus get purified and so forth like that. And that's their help. So what we'll do, we'll just read a little bit here from some of the Bhagavatam verses that Prabhupada referred to in his purport. 325.25, the verse says, "In the association of pure devotees, discussion of the pastimes and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is very pleasing and satisfying to the ear and the heart. By cultivating such knowledge, one gradually becomes advanced on the path of liberation, and thereafter he is freed, and his attraction becomes fixed. Purport says, one must seek the association of persons who are Krishna conscious and who engage in devotional service. Without such association, one cannot make advancement. Simply by theoretical knowledge or study, one cannot make any appreciable advancement. One must therefore give up the association of materialistic persons and seek the association of devotees, because without the association of devotees, one cannot understand the activities of the Lord. So here, Prabhupada is digging deeper here. We've just understood, haven't we, that the association of advanced devotees is what is almost an essential factor of spiritual life. But Prabhupada here is going to more detail. He's saying, it's not just that, but it's about giving up the association as much as possible, of materialistic, mundane persons. And the sadhus, the devotees, are able to help one understand the activities of the Lord. Later on in that same purport, he basically talks about Prabhupada mentions about the difference between impersonalism, Mayavada philosophy, and personalism. And basically he concludes that someone can be a great jnani, study a lot, go to the best university, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, etc. Especially if one's from a wealthy background, they can get bought a degree these days. However, one cannot understand that the Lord is truly a person without the association of the devotees who also understand Krishna, know that Krishna is a person. Trap one is the material energy as a whole, material objects. Trap two is the Mayavada philosophy. And really it's only those devotees that can help us out of those traps. But spiritual life, and one of the reasons why the simplicity and poverty is in some way glorified perhaps at this point, is because spiritual life, the fundamentals of spiritual life in its traditional sense, is simple living, high thinking. Not entangling ourselves more and more in these complex cities and making our lives more and more complex. And indeed, the more material opulence we acquire or inherit, the more complicated things actually get. And it can potentially, not always, there are obviously advanced people who are also wealthy, but in general, it would be very, very intoxicating, frankly. Why? Okay, as I mentioned earlier, more property, more protection, more defense, bodyguards, security, CCTV cameras, fear of being burgled, etc. More fear. Someone's got millions of investments. Every day they've got to watch the value of the pound. More anxiety. Oh my God, Brexit this and this. And everything. There's more things to worry about. But the poor man, he appreciates anything he gets. Offers that to the Lord. And I mean, can you imagine the great piety, actually, of someone who is self-satisfied, because that is the true wealth. One is only wealthy when one is actually Krishna conscious. That is true wealth. So a poor man, like Siddharma Brahman, for example, he was already wealthy, spiritually wealthy, even before he received the reward from Krishna. He was already wealthy because he was a great devotee of the Lord. More wealthy than all the Maharajas and with their palaces and property. That is the spiritual understanding. Of course, Brahmanas, sadhus, sannyasis, and so forth, are inherently supposed to be a little bit poor, actually. Bhrigu Muni, of course, I mentioned that last time, but I like the story, so I'll say it again. Bhrigu Muni was sent on a mission to find out who was superior out of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. So he went to visit all of them and insulted them in different ways. With Brahma, which was his father, it was a non-verbal offence. He simply went to Brahmaloka, and then his Brahma went, "Oh, Bhrigu, my son, how are you?" And Bhrigu just ignored him. That was insulting. So Brahma got pretty angry, especially because he's in charge of the modes of passion. But then Bhrigu explained to him it was just a test. Then Bhrigu Muni did a verbal offence to Lord Shiva, and look at you, Shiva, look at you, you've got snake around your neck, you're dirty, you don't even comb your hair, what kind of a demigod are you? So Shiva got really, started to do his dance, and of course he had to pacify Shiva. It's okay, it was just a test, So then, of course, Bhrigu then went, of course, to see Vishnu lying there in the ocean with his feet massaged there by the goddess Lakshmi. And then Bhrigu did a huge offence by kicking Vishnu in the chest. And Vishnu just went, "Oh, I'm sorry if my hard chest has damaged your lotus feet." In other words, Vishnu was extremely, extremely humble in his reaction, in his response. It was only Lakshmi Devi, as a protective wife, that would have none of this. "What have you done to my husband? You've kicked my Lord Vishnu in the chest. How dare you? From now on, Bhrigu, Brahmins will always be poor. I will never bless them." Of course, this is coming from Lakshmi. "I will never bless you." So therefore, we can see that Brahman is, in one sense, accursed by providence, actually, to be not particularly materially opulent. So that's what goes on there. So this is very understanding. And yet, in the modern world, we're not taught these type of principles. There's a glory, there's an honour, there's a prestige of being simple. The simple Brahmana in his hermitage is the most opulent hermitage. For the Supreme Lord is at the centre. Because you cannot put a price on peace of mind. You cannot put a... There's so many Maharajas. Look at Maharaj Prataparuja, for example. So many Maharajas that had so many things to worry about. The kings have got so... invading kingdoms, feeding the military, military campaigns, taxes, famines, all the different things that kings, ancient kings and contemporary prime ministers, for example... Brexits, all those anxiety they have to go through, all based initially on their ambition, and yet it does not lead them to happiness. It is only really the sadhus and the brahmanas that can really say that they are happy, and those, of course, who associate with them. And yet, in the Kali Yuga, as it described in the 12th canto, the effects of the Kali Yuga, without, which is lacking in Krishna consciousness, give the impression, get everything is the wrong way around. Everything is the wrong way around in the Kali Yuga. And one of the symptoms, as described in the Bhagavatam, is that saintliness will be judged by how much money one has, for example. And actually, the truth is, I won't say it's always the opposite, but in general, it's the opposite way around. People are such fools because they are essentially brainwashed by the commercial rat race and the modern media, where the sense of greed, opulence, acquiring things we don't really need, prioritizing the things we shouldn't be prioritizing, etc., is pumped down our throats on a daily basis. That is because it suits the economy, actually. However, this is nothing to do with saintliness at all. There's great examples, as many great examples. I was mentioned about different kings. So I was just thinking about different kings who are unbelievably wealthy, wealthier than any king or president that is around today, or any owner of Microsoft or whatever it might be. For example, if you look at Maharaj Yudhisthira, after the terrible Mahabharat war, Maharaj Yudhisthira, he renounced it. After, I think he ruled, is it, for about 120 years after the Mahabharat war. And there was the Rajasuya sacrifice, and he was declared officially emperor of the entire civilized world, which would have been most of the world, actually. Not just what we know as India today, but Maharaj Yudhisthira's empire would have been all of Asia, actually. East Africa, Asia, right across. India, obviously. Indonesia. And yet... when he saw the symptoms of Kali Yuga coming, the dogs howling, the weather changing, disasters, people changing, i.e. the effects of Kali Yuga taking place, he decided it was time for him to go and to pass on that, of course, to Maharaj Pariksit. And him and the other Pandavas, just remember, they were very, very opulent, and they fought so hard for their kingdom. They fought so hard for their kingdom. They waited 14 years, living in the forest, of course, even though they were princes and kings, or should have been princes and kings, yet they were living 14 years in the forest, just like Lord Ram as well. And yet, ultimately, they were detached from their wealth. The Pandavas, of course, then gave up their kingdom of Hastinapur, just walked into the Himalayas, and one by one they passed away. Because why? Because they knew what the where truth wealth really was. She should have a Google and Nikki J. She to arm looks at my hand and my key, she should go and say, J. So here's an example of Mara Judisti, who had so much wealth, inherited the kingdom of the world, and yet he was able to move on because he was aware of a higher principle. Of course, Maharaj Prichit himself, again, inherited that wealth. And yet, when he realized he was cursed to be bitten by the snake bird Takshaka, what happened? He turned to the Bhagavatam. He turned to Sukadeva Goswami and said, just recite the Bhagavatam to me now. And at that point, it did not matter about his palaces and his kingdoms and his bank accounts and his gold coins or whatever the king may have had access to. He was just able to get the association of saintly persons and just sit there fasting from food and water and just listening intently to the Bhagavatam. And thus the Bhagavatam was spoken about 5,000 years ago. So that's a very good example of that. Despite, and yet he, Yudhisthira, Parikshit and so on, were far richer than anyone else today, actually. Another good example is Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. They're actually very wealthy background. They're actually secretaries of working, of course, for the Aluddin Hussein Shah, one of the Mughal rulers of the time in the 15th century of India. And yet what happened? They got the association of Lord Titania, and by and large they gave it all up, mostly. They actually had access to so much gold. But it meant nothing to them. And for them, the highest wealth was just be simple, live as simple Goswamis in Vrindavan. And there, waiting, of course, for the association of their Lord and meditating on the Lord. Ambarish Maharaj is a very good example. Again, he was actually not just king of a planet. He actually had, was actually king, emperor of planetary systems. We're talking about former yugas here, of course. Ambarish Maharaj was extremely wealthy, actually. And yet also extremely detached. He was always fasting, performing yajna, praying, meditating, and so forth. So he's a very good example. This is true wealth. And this is also an example. Of course, Ambarish would also take association of the brahmanas. So the point is here, perhaps, it's not that Prabhupada is actually saying that being wealthy is bad. But it's saying that being wealthy means there's a greater need for the association of the devotees. And if a king, whether it's Prithu Maharaj or Ambarish, is clued in, if you like, is smart enough, is pious enough to actually take the association and instruction of the brahmanas, then he is the greatest kind of king. In fact, we find that as a theme throughout the Bhagavatam. All the great kings, the kings that are glorified, are in that category, actually. You'll see that as an ongoing theme, I think. Whereas King Venu and all these, some of these others, a different story. Like that. Prataparuja is a really good one. Obviously, as we all know, it was Gaupani recently, so I mentioned a bit of Chaitanya Leela. Maharaj Prataparuja, the king of Orissa. He was a powerful king. He had a huge army. He actually managed to keep back the Mughal Empire, actually getting into his kingdom. So he was powerful, actually. Very, very powerful. And yet, all he really, really wanted was the association of Mahaprabhu. But Mahaprabhu wouldn't associate with him. He said, well, you know, I'm a sannyasi, and people will misunderstand if I'm kind of hanging around with you in your palace. This won't encourage people. People will think that I've sold out in some way or whatever. Didn't say that, but whatever. So Maharaj Prataparuja, he had to disguise himself as a Brahmin in order to get the association of Mahaprabhu. And there, Maharaj Prataparuja basically recited Krishna Leela to Mahaprabhu, and Mahaprabhu was embraced Maharaj Prataparuja. So here's a wonderful example of a wealthy person, materially wealthy person, being wise enough to take the association of great personalities like that. So I'll move on. We still have 10 minutes, just with some of the other verses that Prabhupada mentioned in his original purport. From 10.8.4. Persons like you move from one place to another, not for their own interests, but for the sake of poor-hearted householders. Otherwise, they have no interest in going from one place to another. So here, of course, the verse is talking about the duty of great munis and sannyasis is to travel and preach. purport. As factually stated by Nanda Maharaj, Garga Muni, being a devotee, had no needs. Similarly, when Krishna comes, he has no needs. He descends to this material world to protect the devotees and vanquish miscreants. This is the mission of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and devotees also have the same mission. One who executes the mission of performing welfare activities for the people in general is recognized by Krishna. Similarly, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has advised this para upakara, and he has especially advised the inhabitants of India. And a quote from the Adilila here. One who has taken his birth as a human being in the land of India, Bharatvarsh, should make his life successful and work for the benefit of all other people. On the whole, the duty of a pure Vaishnava devotee is to act for the welfare of others. So Prabhupada himself here is probably the best example of that. Heap hailing, of course, from Bharat, who travelled around the world and, of course, established ISKCON with the true welfare of the people as his motive. Not mundane philanthropy or a material motive, of course, not at all, but rather, of course, as to spread Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada here is also, of course, saying that it is not just his duty as someone coming from the Indian culture or the Vedic culture, but the duty of all people who come from Bharat to engage and to preach this Krishna consciousness. Very important. Of course, it's understood, as I hinted earlier, that Bharatvarsh, thousands of years ago, thousands and thousands of years ago in former yugas, was not just limited to the Indian today, although that was the main point. It was basically the whole world at one point. And that's what makes India special, because it's the country, more than other countries, which has more of the Vedic culture intact in general than others. And thus the world is blessed. So from the Adilila, 941, Prabhupada writes, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is addressing not only Bengalis, but all the inhabitants of India. It is in the land of India that actual human civilization can be developed. Human life is especially meant for God realization. Anyone who takes birth in the land of India, Bharatvarsh, has the special privilege of being able to take advantage of the instruction and guidance of the Vedic civilization. He automatically receives the basic principles of spiritual life. Okay, listen to this. For 99.9% of the Indian people, even simple village farmers and others, who are neither educated nor sophisticated, believe in the transmigration of the soul, believe in past and future lives, believe in God, and naturally want to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead or his representative. These ideas are the natural inheritance of a person born in India. This is very, very interesting. Because, obviously, from a material point of view, there's a lot of poverty in India, and also, indeed, there's a lot of wealth. There's a huge gap, actually, between the richest and the poorest in India. However, what Prabhupada clearly says is the most important aspect of India is the fact that, in general, in fact, is nearly, 99.9% of Indians believe in God or, you know, some kind of demigod authority of some type. And Prabhupada is essentially saying this is, of course, to their credit, because it's a start. Especially poorer people, of course. Now, richer people, regardless if they're in India or elsewhere, if they're wealthier, then their wealth indeed would be a distraction. However, if a wealthy person is born into the Vedic culture, that can be a great asset, actually, to the sadhus and the preaching mission of Krishna consciousness, because we need the donations, frankly. And this is a wonderful, time-honoured relationship between householders who give, wealthy householders especially, who give to the temple, give to the mission, and in exchange get the association of the sadhus. That is the system, and that is the system we should be also operating, where the temples benefit from the generosity of congregational members, but the congregational members get the benefit of the association of the sadhus. So this is basically connected, of course, to Varna and Ashram as well, where there's a this it's a win-win situation ultimately, and it's natural. Not everyone can be a sadhu, actually. That's also, and not then again, not everyone can be a wealthy, successful businessman. However, if one follows one's inclination, one's vana, and one's ashram, and acts within Vedic culture according to those rules, then things tend to, or supposed to, fit in together like a jigsaw piece. In the uncorrupted version, of course. So I think I will, on that note, I think I'll stop here. We've got a few minutes for maybe some questions or corrections or comments, perhaps, if anyone wants to add anything.